Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yep.
And welcome to Not the Footy Show, our first official podcast. Now, as you probably know, we have been off air since the beginning of the year. We took a break at Christmas, and sadly, while we were off air, the station closed its doors. But I believe, John, you have a little bit of news that it may be back.
Well, with any luck, Information Radio will be resurfacing again. There's a group of hardcore volunteers that have got together, and they're in the throes of resurrecting the service, and so hopefully within the next couple of months we will have some good news about the continuation of Information Radio, and which will mean, of course, we're back on air.
And we must say congratulations to all those volunteers, because I do know they've been working very hard behind the scenes to get the station back on air, so let's hope they can achieve their goal. Well, obviously, we've missed being on air and obviously promoting many of the sports in Western Australia. We have been contacted by many who sort of said, what's going on? Hopefully, that has now sort of cleared up that situation. It has been difficult to get around to doing the podcast because I've been here, there and everywhere at the moment. And I was actually in India at the beginning of the year doing the Hockey India League, and that was when the Cricket World Cup was on. So that was actually really interesting, John, to be in India, which is now, let's be honest, the hotbed for cricket. And it was a broadsheet newspaper. There was 4 pages every day on the cricket leading into the Cricket World Cup. And I have to say, at one point, I think there were 9 ex-players writing columns. And I have to say, 8 of them were absolute rubbish. The only one that was any good was Ian Chappell. I mean, you had Brett Lee, Glenn McGrath, and they were just pathetic.
Well, it's no surprising that Ian Chappell will be leading the charge there, because he's quite a deep-thinking man. I don't know whether Brett or Glenn thinks as deeply as Ian does.
No, but what did you make of the Cricket World Cup? For me, it went on way, way too long.
Okay, if we take away the time that it took for the tournament, everybody agrees it was a far, far too long for a tournament such as that. But if you take away the time, it was a fantastically successful tournament. We missed out a little bit here in Australia because of the arrangement with the host broadcaster, and apart from the games that Australia played, we only really got to see 1-2 other games across the whole month and a half of the tournament. So it dragged a little bit in that sense, but some fantastic cricket.
Now, there were some fantastic games. There was also some fantastic sportsmanship, and the one that stands out for me was AB de Villiers not making any excuses when South Africa bowed out. And I mean, and that was just a brilliant game.
It was a fantastic game. It was funny afterwards talking to some South Africans, and I said, oh, you know, at least they didn't choke this time. And they, to a man, went, of course they choked! They choked, of course they choked! It was just incredible.
No, I think that's a little bit harsh.
When you consider, they picked out that one particular drop catch, in, and when you consider that the noise and everything, that the atmosphere, that those guys wouldn't have heard each other, not a chance, not a chance.
What about, I mean, you're a Dinky Dye Australian, what about the Australians' behaviour at the end? I mean, to me,
broadcaster deserves a lot of criticism for what they did. A whole bunch of blokes that have been in a tournament like that, what do you think they're going to say? What do you think they're going to say? Brad Haddon, I fully support his comments. I don't support them being broadcast.
I think the thing is, Cricket Australia, to me, with the stuff that happened the day after, have to look at themselves, because they should have said, guys, okay, we're going to put a celebration on. Your wives, your girlfriends can all come in, and it's at the hotel, but we're going to take your mobile phones off you. You're not to use those for 24 hours until you're back to normal. And I just think Cricket Australia need to show more leadership, more responsibility, because it wasn't good, and it really showed an ugly side to the team after a fantastic tournament where they'd played superbly.
I have no doubt that that Australian side celebrated no less or no more than any other Australians or any other side in any country celebrating a win of that magnitude. But
they shouldn't have gone on air.
It shouldn't have gone on air. And We've seen it in other sports recently with umpires being mic'd up or referees being mic'd up. The sort of consternation that that can cause. What's on the field is on the field. We watch what's on the field, and that's all we should be doing is watching. The players have got to be left to sort some of these things out for themselves in the language that they choose to use.
The other thing I would raise with that is Shane Warne. I think, when is he going to realise he is no longer a player in the team? And I think it's going to come to a head fairly soon, possibly when Michael Clarke steps down as captain. I think you're going to find that the next captain will turn around and go, look, Shane, you're not part of this team, go away. We don't want you at our after-match parties. You're not part of it anymore. Because I must admit, I think I would, there's nothing worse than a player who won't leave.
Well, I just wish that the Australian public would realise Shane Warne is a brilliant leg spinner, and he's a brilliant leg spinner.
He's a good commentator, actually, to be fair. Some of his comments, I think, on air are pretty good.
He's on a commentary of the
talking,
game.
Yeah, except when he's talking about parties and
yeah.
who he's been hobnobbing with. And
but essentially, that's what you are, Shane. And that's all I care about hearing from you, is about cricket.
Next to Michael Slater, he's a genius.
Yeah, who's Michael Slater standing next to?
Hi, I'm Olympian Adrian D'Souza from India, and you are listening to Not The Footy Show.
And, of course, now you mentioned you were in India for the Cricket World Cup. A little bit of a tie over there for the Asian Cup. Now, India, second we have the two most populous nations on the planet in Asia. What sort of coverage did the Asian Cup get in India?
Zero. There was none of the games were shown until the final. And there was no coverage in the newspapers until the semi-finals. And I used to get two or three newspapers delivered every day to my hotel room so that I could check on what the hockey players were saying in the papers, etc. So there was absolutely nothing. Now, when you think the Cup of African Nations was on at the same time, that was getting quarter of a page to half a page while that was on. So I think that shows where the Asia Cup is in terms of its credibility, its development. It's still not there. Not taking anything away from Australia winning it and their performances in that. I'm just saying the credibility of the tournament, it's still got a little bit of a way to go to get into the consciousness of the press and the media. Because I know even in the UK, it didn't get massive amounts of coverage. The African Nations Cup got
of Nations. That's the one.
Yeah, that got more coverage.
Which is not a surprise when you consider the number of African players playing in the Premier League compared to the number of Asian players, which takes us back to the World Cup and the fact that no Asian team won a game. Probably Australia was the highest scoring team out of all the Asian teams at the last World Cup.
See, I think the Asian Cup, again, there were two or three teams that just were not good enough even to be playing in that. Now, it's a difficult question. How do you bring in teams to get them to develop to reach that stage? But there were teams that just really weren't good enough. If you look at the Asian Cup, there were only four teams that were ever going to be in with a chance of winning it, possibly only three. And I just wonder whether having four pools was the right way to go, whether they've got to revamp the way it is for the time being to boost the standard, to then make it more exclusive, and then when the levels get higher, you can then bring in more teams.
Is that not an argument that you could also make about the World Cricket World Cup?
I thought the
Minnows were one of the highlights of the tournament, actually.
They were, but in football, I don't think it's the case. I think the gap is just, it's very rare at international level that those minnows will upset.
I suppose that in cricket, every dog has its day, and if the dog has its day, it does well. But, you know, in football, when the dog has its day, it means it draws instead of loses. It's not a win sort of scenario.
I mean, this is where, if you look at the FA Cup, prime example, it used to be fairly commonplace for teams in the third division to knock off a first division team before the Premier League started. Now there is so much money in the Premier League, the squads are so big, the calibre of the players, they're all international players. Now for a third division side to do something like that, it is a very, very rare occasion. Yes, it does still happen occasionally, but not with the regularity that it used to. And look, it's a difficult question. As I say, you want to see these nations in Asia develop, but at the moment there are sort of three or four nations that are just so far ahead of those others. And then there's a sort of second band of nations, and then there's the third, but the gap between the third and the second is far greater than the one between the second and the first.
Hi, I'm JC Jand from West Coast Fever, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, it hasn't all been football and cricket since we were last on air. We've also seen New Zealand beat Australia at rugby league. We've seen the West Coast Fever. Whoa, how are they going? It's great to see those girls finally get some sort of success for their efforts, because they work as hard as any sportsman do. We know that, and it's fantastic to see their success this season. So
it is fantastic, and I think big hats off to Stacey Rossman. You know, first of all, she was a player with the Orioles and the early days of the Fever under Sue Gordian. And, you know, she saw all of the problems from a playing perspective, moved into coaching and was the assistant, you know, this last season. And I think the one thing she's shown is she's really watched, learnt, taken her experiences on the court. She's also managed to identify talent really well. If you look, the New Zealand player whose name I've forgotten, it's the first New Zealand player to play for an Australian franchise. Now, that girl is now, I believe, almost sort of being looked at for the New Zealand team now. And that was a player that was nowhere. So credit to Stacey Rossman for what she's done to create the team, and credit to all the players for obviously performing this time around.
And one of the most pleasing aspects of that is that she is a local girl, and that's going to breed a culture, if you like, that perhaps has been missing. A local homegrown girl is leading the charge for a local homegrown team, and we know how important that is for locals in WA to think that that's, you know, they love the John Wurz fold, they love their local heroes, and she's turning into one of them, and a credit to her.
I think the other thing that's important that you touch on there is the fact that she's been involved in the coaching development and the development of the game here in Western Australia. So she will have touched so many young girls in that role that now they want to be a part of what she's developing at the Fever. So there's that groundswell of support and a groundswell of interest. And so, yeah, I think it's been really, really good from that perspective as well.
Hi, I'm Willie Miller, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Now, we mentioned the Asian Cup, the local A-League, Melbourne Victory. Big 3-0. That's a big victory in a grand final, 3-0.
And what a one-sided affair it was.
You think so?
I was. I mean, you couldn't say any other team deserved to win it.
Did Arnold talk it up too much pre-game?
Yeah. Look, I think he was probably surprised at how much Melbourne Victory got in his players' faces. I think Graham Arnold, to be honest, did really well to get Sydney into the finals when you look at the start of the season that they had.
And the injuries they copped during the season. That
and you
big.
Still wonder how they managed to do all the recruiting they did and come in under the salary cap, to be honest.
We'll get to that.
But, you know, it's again, I think the sad thing is people with the A-League are manufacturing rivalries, and you can't do that in that they're trying to manufacture this Sydney versus Melbourne thing. And yes, there is a bit of a rivalry there, but it's not to the extent that everybody's making it out to be. But look, Arnold's done well with Sydney this year. But I think, again, the fact that they made it into the finals kind of showed how bad the league was this year. There'll be some people will say, oh, it was a close league, so it was a good competition. The fact there was nobody at any stage in the season grabbed the season by the scruff of the neck and said, we're going to win this title. And
not like Brisbane in previous years, who were streets ahead.
Yeah, and Melbourne Victory did it a few years ago. Adelaide did as well. And there was, but there was no team. It just kept chopping and changing because nobody could actually string together a good run of results. And I thought this year was actually the worst of what I saw. I was away for a fair bit, but I have to say, the games I saw, I thought the standard was the worst I've seen in the A League.
Okay, that's a big call.
Yeah, I thought some of the football this year was awful.
What do you make of what happened with Perth Glory? Now, we mentioned salary caps and player rosters earlier. I must admit, I'm staggered to think with the roster that the Perth Glory had, the rosters that other sides had, that Perth are the only ones paying overs.
I don't think they are. I think anyone who thinks that Perth Glory is the only team to have been rorting the system has got their head in the sand. But I think the difference was they weren't very clever at it and disguising it. Now, the other thing I will say, and of course everybody knows that there's been accusations that it was a whistleblower that released all the information to Fairfax, who then put pressure on the FFA. The thing I would say about that is if you don't want whistleblowers, then you have to make sure when you fire people, you pay them what they deserved or what their contract says. Now, we know for a fact that Perth Glory on many occasions now have got rid of coaching staff and have not paid them what is owed. And so you're going to have disgruntled staff if they're not given the financial recompense that that position is meant to get. While we've been off air, Boxing Australia came over to Western Australia and they conducted some clinics which I was very fortunate to attend and get down and watch, and they were superb clinics run over a weekend. And Jamie Pittman from Boxing Australia was the man conducting those. Of course, he was a very successful amateur and also had a short spell as a professional boxer. And I caught up with him during his visit, so we'll now hear from Jamie Pittman. Jamie Pittman, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hey, how you going, buddy?
Well, before we talk about why you've come across to Perth and the National Boxing Program, I wanted to obviously look back on your sort of involvement with boxing and how all that got started, because I believe it was an accident that actually you got involved in the sport.
I was 9 years old. Been a very excited kid. I was trying to open a window in hide and go seek, and my hand went through the window and it came down like a guillotine, and I lost two veins and I almost hit me artery in my left hand. So I went to the doctors when I was nine, and he said, go over the Newcastle PCYC and strengthen it over there, son. So I went over there, and as soon as I walked in the gym, that was me. I knew that was me destiny. So I got 62 stitches in my left arm, and still can't straighten it completely in my left arm today. So still trying to strengthen it up for the doctor.
What was it when you walked in there that made you think, this is for me?
I don't know. I guess I was lucky to, when I was a kid, that I walked in, I felt like I belonged there. So it was kind of my belonging when I walked in there. I was starting to get some structure in my life, and I had an aim and a goal already at age 10, so I was just addicted straight away.
But how difficult was it to recover and build the strength up in that arm?
Yeah, it was extremely hard, and there was times where the doctor would say that, you know, maybe boxing's not for you, maybe we go to more of a Pilates or stretch it to see if we can get some more strength in it, but there was no way I was leaving that boxing gym, so, yeah.
Once you found you belonged, what was your goal? Commonwealth Games? Was it Olympics? Or was that a dream that was too far ahead at that time?
Olympic gold medal. I remember in 1992, I was 11. I sat there and watched Kieran Perkins win a gold medal in swimming at the Olympic Games, and the media just went ballistic. And I was thinking, that's what I'm going to do. I want Sydney Olympics. honour win a gold medal in my hometown. So, you know, from a very young age, at 10, I was already had 8 years set in my mind that I'd be going to Sydney. So, fortunately, I missed out on Sydney. But then I didn't give up and thought, well, it's only 4 years, so I just kept digging deep to make Athens.
Sydney was a little bit controversial, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit controversial. I was ahead in the last qualifiers, and I got cut from a head clash. They called it a punch. I was ahead 14-1 on the scorecards, and they gave it to the other guy. But you know, I was very distraught at the time and angry. But I just need to reset myself and go again. You know, some people could have said, "Oh, well, I had a good go." A good go is not good enough for me. I need to walk out on that stadium. So,
you said 4 years wasn't that long, and you said how there you were very upset about it. Do you think in a way that boxing taught you that you've got to put that anger aside and get back to focusing on the job in hand?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wasn't in a good place, but I kept it all to myself, which wasn't good. I probably should have sat with someone, had a bit more of a talk to someone higher and specialised in that stuff, but it worked out for me that that's the way I could deal with it a bit more, you know, head down and train a bit harder and a bit stronger and sacrifice a bit more, and that's what gave me my happiness.
After that disappointment, when you were selected for, qualified for Athens, how did you feel then?
Oh, I still remember the phone call today of ringing my mum. My mum's been a great support for me my whole career. I remember giving her a ring from Tonga where the qualifications were, and she answered the phone and said, "Hello?" And I said, "Hey, Mum." She goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Yeah, I've done it." And it was a great feeling. It was a dream come true for me. So I put a lot of work and a lot of sacrifice into that dream. So
must have been disappointing, though, how it all panned out when you got to Athens, though.
Yeah, it was. I thought I beat the German. It was day one, and I put him down twice, and I still thought I'd done enough to win, but I didn't really have a good think at the time. Looking back now, I probably should have once again reset and said, "All right, well, Beijing, 4 years, let's get a gold medal there." But I kind of reacted a bit, I'd say immature and turned professional. So something that I never wanted to do. But I was just a bit angry and distraught at the time, and I was thinking 4 years is too long to do that all over again and maybe go through the emotional role that I just did.
You said there you didn't want to turn professional. Why was that?
I love the Olympic sport, and I love the Commonwealth Games and what that means to the world. You know, I think if you go to the Commonwealth Games, Olympic Games, it's a whole new world, that village. Like, it's a world that you can't explain. Like, it's just, yeah, it's paradise. Yeah, and I wanted that feeling again, but whether I could go through the pain of Athens again, that was the problem. I never wanted to turn professional. I didn't believe in the professional outlook. So, and I do now. I those thoughts are in mind now as well as a coach.
Even though you did have a pretty successful professional career.
Yeah, well, I was a housing commission kid, so I really wanted to own my own home, and the only way I could do that was either win an Olympic gold medal or turn professional. So I turned professional and said, well, if I get enough for a down deposit, that'll do. So, and then I just kept winning titles and thought, well, this is working out quite good now, and I got another dream. I always wanted to fight for a world title final at the world championships. But I think the WBA was my world title final against Felix Sturm. Though that was another roller coaster for me, so it was good.
Exactly. It's funny, though, when you look back on when you were fighting as an amateur, how the sport has now changed, because that fight in Athens with the point scoring now, you probably would have won it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, I would have had a couple of 10-8 rounds. The judging system's always been controversial, and apart from boxing, to be honest, whenever judges are involved with sport, it's a bit controversial. So, you know, gymnastics and diving and stuff like that. You know, things that get controversial when judges are involved. So I guess there's no way around it. We have to settle for a scoring system and just trust the people that we've educated.
Do you think the system now is fairer?
Yeah, I mean, I like the computer scoring, to be honest. I think it was more visual to see where the crowd could see where the fighters were at. You got to see where you were at as a fighter. I like the computer scoring, but this way, I think it's, yeah. I think as long as we educate the judges correctly, I think it'll work out a lot fairer at the Olympic Games.
I mean, at least now you're getting points for good defensive work and also for being aggressive, whereas before it was always just if three judges saw the punch land.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and different. You see different things from different angles as a judge. I've done a little bit of practice judging down the institute, and it's quite difficult. So whenever people ask me about judging and refereeing, I always say, well, that's not my job. You know, it's a hard job, and someone's got to do it. So and they're the ones that educate them and get educated on that. So it'd be extremely hard to sit there for a few hours and score clearly, you know.
I think that was where, again, the Cubans kind of dominated, because they learnt to get in, throw punches where the judges could see it, and then they'd get out.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're already starting to adjust for the new scoring system. To be honest, it probably freshens up the sport, the change back, you know. And we've got headgears off now, which I sit on the fence with the headgears. I think yeah, it's possible to have no headgears, but I think they need to put something in there. I don't know what it is, a bit of structure to keep the boxers safe leading into the finals, so we've got the two best boxers in the final that have fought their way there. So
you're involved in coaching now, and how much, A, are you enjoying it, and B, how different is it from being told what to do to actually telling people what to do?
Yeah, well, I actually feel I'm a better coach than I was a boxer. I feel I get to explain what I should have done. I love the coaching, and once again, I've set three major goals in my coaching, and I won't stop until I get those goals, and usually when I want something, I get it. So I really enjoy the coaching. I'm lucky to be mentored by two or three of the best coaches around, which is Don Abnett and Kevin Smith, and my previous Olympic coach, Bodo. I have chats with him, but Kevin Smith is a breath of fresh air in Australian boxing at the moment. He's very person-centred, and he's got all these his mind on the boxers and developing boxers and coaches.
You said you feel you're a better coach, but sometimes, you know, southpaws are regarded as very boring fighters. You were a southpaw. Do you find, though, again, it's easy adjusting as a southpaw as a coach, or do people find it difficult maybe when you're trying to explain something the wrong way around?
Yeah, well, at my development camps, I have to be mindful of that, and when I do a demo, I have to quickly switch and do it as an orthodox, because, you know, most of the athletes these days are orthodox. So, lucky enough, there was times where during training that I would get some drills as an orthodox just to be able to punch off both feet, so I can switch and do a demo quite well. So I love this new development role that gets branched out across the country. I think it's fantastic that we're not keeping all the secrets at the institute, and we're spreading it out so that the country lifts. So
now, it's been really good to see the numbers here in Perth that have been participating in that. You've been putting a lot of emphasis on foot movement. Do you feel now with the aggressive side that, you know, you're getting points for being aggressive, that the foot movement is crucial?
Yeah, well, the good thing about it's a good foundation to start with your feet, because, let's be honest, the feet control most of your body in all sports, you know, football, table tennis, boxing. Your feet control a lot of situations, whether you're a heavy-handed fighter or a nice, smooth, fast-moving boxer. So a good foundation is to start with the feet. So you could probably walk down the street and teach someone how to punch, but you couldn't walk down the street and tell someone to move correctly with their feet. So I think that's a good outlook to build a good foundation.
One of the things I find interesting is looking at the numbers. There's a lot of young boys here. There always have been, but it seems that mothers now that they're doing boxing to stay fit seem far happier to let their young sons get involved.
Yeah, well, I've always said that boxing's an extremely safe sport, and we wrap services and around boxing. It's one of the only sports where you get a medical assessment before and after the bout. You know, football on the weekend, you don't have doctors turn up and assess every single player and then assess them after the game as well. So I think people are starting to become more aware that, you know, we've got some great support wrapped around these kids, female and male.
With a little bit of money coming into the sport now in the amateur structure, do you think it's going to make it harder for Australia to get those medals at Olympics?
It's the qualification's more difficult now as well. We have to qualify through Asia, East Asian Games. So, but I feel that that's going to lift us, because when we do have people qualify, we do have general chances at a medal. So if you qualify for the Olympic Games now, you're going to be a big chance for a medal because of the way that you got there. So it's I think it's an exciting times, especially with the new coaching staff that we've got with Boxing Australia.
And this coaching path, I'm presuming it's a long-term view. It's not just looking 4 years ahead, looking at some of the boys that have come down today. You're looking at 8, 12 years ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the way that the you know, Kazakhstan and Cuba and that do it. I identify athletes and I send emails constantly to Kevin and Don. Having a look at, can you have a look at those athletes? And they respond and they go out to the States and their home gyms and talk to their coaches and the athletes. So I think it's a great way to develop our young boxers, male and female.
Well, Jamie, great catching up with you. Thanks very much for your time and all the very best.
Thanks heaps, mate. Been a pleasure.
Hello, my name is Joe Cortez, international boxing referee from Las Vegas, Nevada, the boxing capital of the world. Listen to Not the Footy Show. It's a knockout. Check it out.
And that was Jamie Pittman from Boxing Australia, who was over here in Western Australia working with Boxing WA, putting on some clinics for some up-and-coming young boxers. Now, there's a lot of people criticise boxing, John, but to me, it is a great sport for a lot of kids to get involved with. It teaches them discipline. It gets them fit. And I mean, watching some of those young boys, and they had them, I think they were from about age 8 to about 15, 16, going through those clinics. And if you saw some of the talent, some of the concentration, some of the commitment these young kids had, you could not criticize it as a sport. It was just fantastic to watch. And the coaching and the way it was carried out, again, I've got to give it 10 out of 10.
When I was growing up as a kid, boxers were the fittest sportsmen on the face of the earth. Now, I don't know that in the modern era you could say the same thing, because the rest of the sporting world has almost caught up to boxing as far as fitness and that sort of stuff goes. But, I mean, you've got to be dedicated to be a boxer. You've got to be strong mentally and strong physically. You can get away with a bit of mental weakness playing team sports, but you can't get away with it in a sport like boxing, where it's an individual sport. And to see what it's done for people, oh, we get the media throwing up, oh, here's an ex-boxer that's been punched in the head too many times, listen to him dribble. That's what we get from the media about boxing, whereas there are thousands and thousands. For every one bloke that's having troubles because he was a boxer, there's 100 whose lives are better because of it.
The other thing I'll say about boxing, and this is where I've been very fortunate when I was writing Zuma's book, is spending a lot of time with former world champions. And there is an incredible brotherhood amongst boxers. And boxers help other boxers. Now, you look at other sports and you say, how often does that happen in other sports? Not a lot. There's a lot of other sports where, team sports, where, as Ali McCoy said to me once, you make a lot of acquaintances in football, you don't make a lot of friends. And that's the problem, I think, with modern day sport, is there aren't the friendships you used to have of yesteryear, where you went on tour with guys for a long time. This time around, I think the sad thing is, you know, so therefore when they retire, there's acquaintances, and if they get in trouble, they go, oh, I might go along, but There's not the brotherhood that you get from something like boxing, where you obviously have that respect because you know what every guy has gone through the minute they climb through those ropes.
I'm Caitlin Bassett, and you're listening to Not the Footy
Show. Well, going from one sport where there is plenty of money to one where there is next to none is badminton. Now, I was very fortunate to go to China to commentate the Sudirman Cup, which is a team tournament between all the various nations, and they play men's singles, women's doubles, and mixed doubles, and the winner of that rubber is obviously the winner of the match. Now, sadly for New Zealand, they couldn't raise a team and they didn't have the finances. And so alongside me in the commentary box was a doubles specialist from New Zealand, Ollie Leyden-Davis. And I thought it was just very interesting spending time with him to hear the challenges that he faces to compete at the highest level. And this is a player who all the experts say, if he can find the right partner, would cruise into the top 10 in the world ranking. So he is a quality badminton player, but he's just finding it really tough. But we'll let Ollie Leyden-Davis tell us for himself.
Ollie Leyden-Davis, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you, Ashley. It's nice to be on it.
Well, we're going to talk about your badminton career and obviously the sort of state of badminton in New Zealand. How did you get involved in the sport?
My mum played originally, and then she introduced me to the game when I was 8 years old and started playing like once a week, I guess, down at the local club. And then when I was 14, we had a professional coach that came over from Holland, and that was the first time that anybody who a coach of his level had been in the Waikato region. And at the same time, he identified me in a Waikato squad, and it all sort of started from there.
Did you ever know then that you could make a career out of badminton?
Definitely not, no. I mean, I guess in this part of the world, we all know what a plate final is. So when the first round of losers go into that, and then you all play off. And that was me against actually another guy from our Commonwealth Games team 10 years ago in 2004. So that was my first experience, so not from that.
When did you realise, though, that this was what you wanted to do, that you wanted to make a career out of it?
A couple of things happened in 2008 when I got picked in the national team for the first time, and I was faced with the choice of training up there on Saturday mornings with them or playing cricket or club cricket on a Saturday. So it wasn't much of a choice, really. And then at the same time, there was a ladies singles player who I looked up to who had moved over to Denmark and started playing in the professional leagues over there, and I thought that would be something that would be pretty cool to do.
Do you have any regrets? I mean, there's not the financial rewards you would have had if you'd have played cricket.
No, not at all. I mean, it would have been a lot of work to make it in cricket, but not saying that I would have or maybe wouldn't have, but yeah, not at all. I think this has been a fantastic opportunity, and to live in Europe for 3 years at the same time and now Asia, and I've seen heaps of the world and played a couple of Commonwealth games, so it's been fantastic.
We all know New Zealand famous for its rugby. There's other sports being played. How does badminton rate in New Zealand?
Pretty lowly in terms of coverage and media coverage. But for participation levels, it's quite big. A couple of years ago, it was like the fastest growing secondary school sport. But they just don't have the connections between the schools and the clubs to kind of maintain it. But yeah, coverage levels we get at Commonwealth Games and for New Zealand Open once a year. So it's not huge and really much a minority sport in New Zealand.
You talk about that connection. What's the coaching like? Because it's one thing developing at the younger age, but you still need that development at those vital sort of age group of sort of 16, 17, 18?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's a matter of trying to feed, like everybody plays it in secondary schools, and every time you talk to them, you go, oh, yeah, I played that in high school. It was great. And everybody loves it. But to be able to take those people who enjoy it and are talented at it and I guess feed them into clubs from 15, 16 years of age, maybe that's a little bit late, but you also want the hobby players to be able to enjoy the game as well, so to be able to continue, I guess, people's involvement in badminton in general.
Now, you've said badminton has taken you to Europe, it's got you now in Asia, but you specialise in the doubles side of the game. How did that come about? Was it just a case of you realised singles was maybe a little bit too hard or a little bit too competitive?
Not really. Again, it was more sort of a coach's decision. It all kind of started at the World Junior Championships in 2007, which were actually in New Zealand, which was really cool to be a part of. But I played the men's doubles in that week in my first year as an under-19 player. And me and my partner at the time managed to secure that spot and played a lot of that, and it went quite well. We made the last 16 as well in the individuals, and that was a bit of a highlight. So I guess I sort of got confidence from that and found that that's where I was suited to be.
What does it take to be a doubles player? I mean, you've got to obviously find a partner that's on the same wavelength as you, both in what you want to achieve and communicatively.
Yeah, definitely, and that's the biggest one. I mean, it only takes one player, but haven't really been able to. Me and Kevin had a good time over the last 3 years, but he's obviously chosen to work now, and full credit to him for doing that. It's hard financially to continue, and it must be nice to have like dollars coming in rather than always just going out. But yeah, you need someone who's on the same page as you, and especially in a badminton mind, on court but also off court, with your goals and your dreams and your work ethic and what you're willing to sacrifice, or the choices you're willing to make to achieve those.
Financially, how much support do Badminton New Zealand give you to pursue those dreams and goals and raise the profile of the game?
Financially, almost nil. They fund us to team events. Unfortunately, we didn't have an event here at the Sediment Cup in China this week, and we get a small grant to go to World Championships, but in terms of individual tournaments and I guess qualifying for Commonwealth Games and those sort of campaigns, once you get there, it's okay, but to qualify is all off your own back, so that's the difficulty of it, because we used to have funding, but now there's nothing at all, so it's all self-funded.
You played with your sister, which some would say might be brave. I mean, or have you got a very good relationship with her? Because it could fray family relations.
Yeah, I mean, it does come with its complications, but I think at the end of the day, it's cool to share that experience with a family member at the same time. And the benefit of it is being able to enjoy the good times together, and the good matches we have played have been really, really good. And you do have that understanding, and the communication factor is a lot easier because obviously you know each other so well, and you spend so much time together, and you know how each other think. So when it goes well, it can go really, really well, and that's been happened on a couple of occasions, so that's been great.
But you are at the moment looking for a doubles partner.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, like I said, with Kevin working now, and Susanna also doing her job as well, it's doubles player without any partners, so it's an interesting situation to be in, but hopefully that'll change in the very short future, and we can build looking maybe at 2018 and 2020 Olympics.
We should mention your sponsor at the moment, because they've managed to take you up to Chinese Taipei, and probably without them, you may in fact be out there looking for a job.
Yeah, absolutely. Extreme have been great. And I guess it was a funny story, actually. I was sitting having lunch in December, having come back from Denmark in September with money having run out completely and having to work to refinance and potentially go back again 12 months later. But then I had a text message with this offer, and I think once that offer was on the table, it was always a matter of do I take it or do I stop playing, because it was too good to turn down, really. So I came over for a month trial in January and thought, yeah, this is what I want to do. So here I am today, and hugely grateful for them to allowing me, I guess, to continue my badminton career.
How would you have felt if you'd have had to have given up at this stage in your life?
How do I put this? Unfulfilled, I think. I've always said, like, when I decided that, yeah, I want to give badminton a go, that I don't just want to be a guy that's played a couple of Commonwealth Games. I want to be someone who's competed at the Olympics and not just been there, like genuinely competed with the best and been inside the world top 20 and hopefully medaled at Commonwealth Games as well. And it's a high target to set, but I wouldn't want to stop having not given the Olympics a go. If you don't qualify because I'm not good enough, sure, like I can accept that, no problem. But if you stop having never been able to actually give it a real go, then that would be something that would be disappointing.
Well, Ollie, thanks for that. We hopefully will stay in touch and we can find out how your progress goes and maybe catch up when you find a new partner.
Yeah, that'd be great, actually. Like, cheers, and it's been good commentating with you this week, so enjoyed it.
Hi, I'm Chris Cirillo from the Kookaburras, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Ollie Layden-Davis, the New Zealand badminton player. And if you are out there and you are a New Zealander living in Perth and you want to get behind one of your fellow countrymen, please put your hand in your pocket and give Ollie a little bit of support. If you want to know how to get in touch with him, you can contact me, Ashley Morrison, either via Not The Footy Show on Facebook or via my website, Ashley Morrison Media, and I will put you in touch with Ollie. But it's terrible, John, when you see athletes with talent just restricted so much by, A, in this case, not having a partner that is in New Zealand. And I mean, he sort of wants to compete internationally and he can find a partner from overseas, but the Olympics look like they're going to drift away from him just because there's no one in the country that he can pair up with that can make that standard.
Ollie would not be alone amongst New Zealanders in, because of the nature of their small population, being outstanding at a sport but not having that backup that larger populations give you to provide A, competition, and B, a partner. So good luck to him. I wonder how many other sports people in New Zealand are in a similar boat to him.
Well, you imagine, I mean, there's smaller countries than New Zealand as well. But no, I really feel for him, and I do wish him all the best. And I'm going to stay in touch with him, so hopefully we can follow his path in the coming years. Well, we've probably gone on way too long for this, our first podcast, but we had to just catch up on several sports. We do hope you enjoy it. We'll be bringing you a few more over the coming months until the station gets back up and going. But from me, Ashley Morrison, and
from me, John Lee,
we hope you've enjoyed it and we hope you tune in again soon.
See ya. We'll be back next week.